is Forensic Talk with Jim Campbell, all talk and all crime. Murder Forensics, the birth of American CSI, the little-known American Sherlock on Forensic Talk with Jim Campbell. Kate Winkler-Dawson, a seasoned documentary producer. She teaches journalism at the University of Texas at Austin. She was on this show for her first book, Death in the Air, the true story of a serial killer, the Great London Smog, and the strangling of a city. And this one just out is American Sherlock, Murder Forensics, and the birth of American CSI. Welcome back from Austin. Kate, how are you?
Thanks, Jim. Thanks for having me. I'm great.
We like anything with forensics in the title, by the way. So.
Well, I noticed that. Yeah, I thought this I'd be a shoo-in for the show.
Yeah, it's already in good grace. I have to say, though, you pick out these esoteric topics. I had never heard of Oscar Heinrich. And tell us how you picked him and got interested in who he is.
Sure. So we'll start with who he is. So Oscar Heinrich, it was Edward Oscar Heinrich, technically, was a forensic scientist who worked out of Berkeley, California, from about 1910 until 1953 when he died. And during that time period, he closed more than 2,000 cases. Not all of them were criminal, but a large portion were. So he worked on some of the craziest Sherlock Holmes-esque cases in the country and in history, and he was embroiled in quite a lot of controversies, both publicly and then personally. He struggled with a lot of demons. And so he, of course, was just this incredible character for me to dive into, and just someone who was really pivotal in the role of developing forensics in the United States. So, you know, he and his contemporaries just were winging it for a little while, and as they went, they were developing these new techniques for the first time, new tools, you know, using things for the first time in America, solving these, you know, unsolvable cases, and essentially, you know, flabbergasting everybody in America, especially with, you know, Heinrich's moniker, which was America's Sherlock Holmes. You know, he just had this razzle-dazzle about him that made him a legend until he died. And then he was essentially wiped from the history books, except in the world of forensics. So,
why was that? Why had we had not heard of this guy? Because it's
right. So, sorry, I interrupted you. You know, I would kind of challenge, if people ask me that all the time, I would challenge anybody to name a forensic scientist that is, you know, like, with the exception of Sherlock Holmes. You know, these are not guys who appear in the media that often. You know, you have the scientists who appeared at the O.J. Simpson case, but these are people who work behind the scenes in a lab wearing a coat. They appear at trial, but usually they're summarized by that forensic scientist who offered X, Y, and Z to the jury. So, you know, these aren't the people who are right front and center in the public eye. Now, Heinrich was in his time because the cases that he was drawn into were so crazy, and we'll talk about those in a little bit. But, you know, now people are so siloed, I think. You know, you've got bloodstain pattern analysts, ballistics analysts, toxicologists. You don't have that person that kind of could walk in and do 20 or 30 different tests. Yeah. From many different disciplines. And I think in Heinrich's time, that was really relevant. But as time went on, there became more sort of, you know, singular experts. And I think he just, you know, was just lost after that. There weren't very many scientists just in general.
Mm-hmm.
He doesn't even have a Wikipedia page, which is very telling, because I'm pretty sure my neighbor even has a Wikipedia page.
What? Tell us about his childhood a little bit, though. That was pretty difficult.
It was. So he grew up first in Wisconsin, and then his father moved the family, his two sisters and his mother, to Tacoma, Washington. He was born in 1881, and he had a hard time. His father was constantly struggling with finances. He was a carpenter and just was a horrible money manager. And, you know, he died really tragically and very suddenly when Oscar was 16. Oscar was the one to find his body. And I think it traumatized him for a couple different reasons. One was, you know, his father died because of financial issues. And Oscar was forever plagued by that. I mean, it was a demon that chased him his entire life. Mm-hmm. He was more scared of debt collectors than he was of the criminals he was, you know, chasing. So he constantly lived in fear of filing for bankruptcy. So there was that. And then the flip side was, I think he became a forensic scientist because of his father's death, but not in the way you might think. When his father died, Oscar, even though he was the youngest child, because he was the boy, he had to take on the financial responsibility of his mother and his two older sisters. So he was an incredible student in high school, but he had to drop out at 16 and immediately start working, and he got a job as kind of a cleanup boy at a pharmacy in Tacoma. And the pharmacist there encouraged him to become a pharmacist himself when he turned 18. We had no money to take formal classes, so he just read books and still passed the state certification test, which was incredible. He became a pharmacist at 18, and that, I believe, was the beginning. So he learned about toxicology, drugs, medicinal whiskey. He brewed it, medicinal whiskey. Yeah. He learned about handwriting analysis because he had to decipher all of the horrible handwriting from the doctors. And I think most importantly, he started getting his deductive reasoning skills by watching these pharmacy visitors come in, beg for drugs they weren't, you know, supposed to be given, lying, cheating. He really was an astute observer, and that really was the beginning of it. So I don't know if he would have been a forensic scientist had he not been forced into that role as provider and taking that job at a pharmacy.
Interesting. And he was OCD?
I think that's an understatement. And I think I might be a little bit, because when I walked into his archive, I immediately recognized it, and I appreciated it, and I understood why nobody else has done a book on him, because it was more than 100 boxes, and I joke that he's a productive hoarder. So he, you know...
He was organized, you mean?
He was incredible, and that was his real legacy. I mean, I can list off other things that he did. You know, forensics that we use now. But I think his legacy was he taught other forensic investigators through his classes of criminology at UC Berkeley, which were the first classes of criminology in the country. Hmm. He taught these investigators how to meticulously, and that is also underlined three times and in bold, how to meticulously collect evidence at a crime scene, record it, catalog it, and then analyze it. And no one had really done that before, particularly somebody who knew so many different disciplines. So, you know, that was when he collected evidence, And at this archive, I had to petition to have it opened. It had been closed for more than 60 years because it was so big. It took the archivist, who finally agreed to do it after I pleaded with the university, it took the archivist a year and a half just to get through his cases.
Wow.
Because it was incredible. So they found the array of things they found, aside from his case files, were amazing. He had two or three loaded pistols from a couple of different cases that he just never disarmed. So they had to take the firing pins out. UC Berkeley police had to come and take the firing pins. There were bomb parts. He had taken a bullet out of a victim's heart, you know, who had deceased, victim's heart, and filled the hole in the heart with a wax, and so he could make it a wax mold. It was bizarre. He had the locket from a woman in a case who had been run over by her own limousine six times, so somebody was really motivated to kill her. You know, I mean, he had a lock of hair from the Fatty Arbuckle case. You know, things that he shouldn't have kept, probably should have been in some sort of locked up police room. But, you know, he had. It was amazing for somebody who's trying to create a profile of this man who had such an impact on history. It just was this ephemeral, you know, material that was incredible for me.
Did you go through all of it?
I did. You know, I went through as much as I possibly could.
Wow.
I went through all of his evidence. So, you know, all of the ephemeral stuff. Like, he had... it's called exemplars, which are, you know, the lettering that's used when you do handwriting analysis.
Mm-hmm.
He had like 1,000 of these letters cut out and printed. So I went through all of this stuff, which now people I don't think can touch. Now that it's actually been cataloged, I'm pretty sure, you know, it's like in a display case. And I was just sort of thumbing through all this stuff. So I went through all of the evidence, and then I went through, he had so many case files. I told my editor this for the first time. She was a little stunned. I said, the reason that the way I picked the cases in the book is I just asked the archivist, send me a list of his thickest files. And so that was it. I mean, what else am I going to do? It was like 1,000 criminal cases. And so that's how I picked them. And I think she sent me maybe 15, and I narrowed it down. Because as an author, that's what you want. You want all that material, absolutely. And so I got the cases that had his trial transcripts, his evidence, his notes. But he had boxes, 40 years worth of work journals. And it wasn't just journals that were like, I did this today, here's the evidence I collected. It was phone calls with each case, wow. chronicled in the side. It was in times, in phone numbers of the people. He chronicled when he woke up, when he went to bed. Wow. He kept like levels of his, the amount of urine that he had for the first year and a half. I think he wanted to open a urinalysis lab. So he really was remarkable. But what was telling about the OCD that you were mentioning mm-hmm. was he had 40 years of journals of every penny he spent on everything, on milk, on, you know, petrol, wow. on whatever. And it was so detailed and so manic.
Yeah, that's his father, right there.
It really was. And he was so paranoid, about collecting money that he was owed. He sent one person a letter once a month for like 4 years to try to collect money. And he had threatening letters from lenders. And so, you know, this amassed amount of information was incredible. He kept, he tried to be an author himself. He wanted to be a novelist. And he wrote just horrible detective novels. He kept those. And so, you know, when I work at an archive, sometimes I picture authors going in and sitting there thumbing through boxes and then going home and, you know, looking at the material and, like, drinking a brandy or something by a fire. And that is not what I do. I'm there 12 hours a day, if they allow me to, frantically taking photos of everything. I don't read anything. I just, like, go through it at breakneck speed, and then I sort it out later and trash stuff that I don't need. So my, you know, attitude is to throw a net and grab it all, and then, you know, toss things out later.
So you don't have them make copies. You take photos of everything?
Oh, yeah, I take photos of everything. Because they're high res, you know, and I can blow things up and crop them and all that stuff. And then I can, I almost never work off of hard copies on anything.
Really?
Yeah.
Are you using an iPhone, or what are you taking pictures with?
Yeah, an iPhone. So I got, wow. I know this sounds silly, but, you know, I've used every version of iPhone on all the books I've done. But I got the 11 specifically because of this. Because I can really take sharp photos. And then what I do is I'll compile, you know, like if I take photos of, let's say, his book, I'll take 4 or 5 pages out of a 150-page book that he wrote. I don't need any more than that. I'm not going to go in depth about the plot. I just need a sample of his writing. Mm-hmm. And then when I get home, I'll take those JPEGs and I'll combine them into one PDF. And I'll name it, and then I can go through the PDF later on and use comments. You know, I can mark.
Interesting.
Yeah, and it's the best way for me to organize. I'm a real, like, OCD organizer in Dropbox of all my files.
Wow. I went through 15,000 pages of the trial transcripts on the Madoff trial. How about that? 15,000 pages.
It's incredible. I mean, and that's you know, you must have really been hyper-organized to keep track of that.
What I did was they were in 50 volumes in a CD of 300 pages each, so I just set how much I was going to do for every day through the next X week so that it came.
Yeah.
Really, you learned a lot about it, so you have to do that kind of work.
You do, and I had probably about 4,000-ish of his letters, and I had to narrow it down by my time period. I settled on starting a chapter with 1933. It ends with the same case. It bookends.
Yes.
So it ends in 1933, and you kind of go backwards in the second chapter and learn his journey from 1920 until that case concludes at the end of the book. And so I really, if anybody else wants to write a book on him, yeah. I have his letters from the 40s and 50s because you just can't do it. You have to figure out, narrow it.
This time period ends up being a good match for him, right? Because I didn't realize how much moral decay and crime increased, during Prohibition and everything.
Oh yeah, and for me, as I think for anybody who writes narrative nonfiction, especially for me, I write historical true crime. The time period is so important. So listen to this time period that I covered. So I went from Prohibition to the Roaring Twenties, where basically anybody could get money from banks, to the Great Depression. With the exception of the Gilded Age, there were no better time periods to me in the U.S. It's really remarkable. And so, you're able to look at his, if you're looking at a narrative arc of an entire book, you're establishing the character at the beginning, why we care, here are the stakes, why you should finish the book, and then, you kind of build the tension, and, at the top of the narrative arc is the climax, and for him, it's really hitting right at the Great Depression, and that is the climax of the United States. I think even now, it just signifies everything that happened, that just fell apart with the U.S., and so it was fortuitous for me to be able to chronicle also, this is getting to be the height of forensics in the first half of the 1900s. And so it all just worked really well for me to kind of create, what my agent likes to call 70% story and tension and really oh my God, what is going to happen next? And the 20 to 30% kind of medicine, this is what you learn, and this is what we know now, and this is why some forensics is really good, and some is bad, and why we can kind of hang both of those things on Oscar Heinrich.
Now, in terms of his deductive reasoning or the science aspect, what are the things that you thought were the most impressive that he came up with before we go into some of the cases?
Well, so, I think the deductive reasoning that he knew, that he really, there's two cases. One that's in the book and one that's not in the book. And the one that's in the book that I love is the Siskiyou train robbery, which is how I found it. So I found him because I read a story in a book that I bought about this incredible botched train robbery where these three brothers are just in the wind. They kill four people with a shotgun. They blow apart a large part of this train in Oregon in 1923, and they're gone into the piney woods of Oregon. And Oscar is brought in because they've arrested a mechanic that has some grease on a pocket. They have this pair of overalls that's left behind. And the cops are stymied. There's not enough evidence to put this mechanic away. And there are two more people that witnesses say were on the train, robbing it. So, all of this really is, stumping even federal agents who were sent down from Southern Pacific Railway and U.S. Postal. And so he's given these overalls, and he makes a lot of deductions based on trace evidence. Some of, the height and weight of this guy, some of, what he did for a living, which was really incredible. He deduced that this guy was a logger, not a mechanic, for a couple of reasons. One, he found out through a microscope that this wasn't mechanic's grease. This was actually the pitch from a fir tree.
Pretty amazing.
From a very specific area of Washington State.
Yeah.
And he knew this guy was a logger because of the way he wore the overalls, how he folded the tail, the bottom of the overalls. He knew the height and weight based on the size of the overalls and what he knew the habits were of loggers. He said they always buy overalls one size bigger than their actual weight.
Pretty amazing.
And so he guessed 175 pounds. And that's basically what the guy weighed who was wearing the overalls. And he knew, there were all of these pockets. And he was able to kind of really dig into the pockets and found the key piece of evidence that was able to really trace them.
Which was the serial numbers, right? We'll get back to this. We're talking with Kate Winkler-Dawson. We'll be right back with more cases from American Sherlock when we get back.
Would you like to host your own radio program or podcast? Park City Productions 06604 is a Bridgeport, Connecticut-based radio broadcast solutions company. Follow us on Instagram, like us on Facebook, and subscribe to our YouTube channel. That's Park City Productions 06604. Call us at 203-522-8801.
And we're back with Kate Wakeford-Dawson. American Sherlock, Murder, Forensics, and the Birth of American CI is her new book. And we had just started off with that great train robbery that failed. Why don't we talk about Fatty Arbuckle next, because he was so famous. Tell folks who he was again and then the story.
Sure. So Fatty Arbuckle was a silent film star from the 1920s, and not just a silent film star, the biggest. And I don't mean just biggest as in the star. He was hefty also. He had a movie in the movie theaters in 1921. He had just wrapped another movie. He was the wealthiest Hollywood star at the time. So he was on top of the world. And his manager wanted to throw him a huge shindig at the St. Francis Hotel, which is a really swanky, still is a swanky hotel in San Francisco. So he drove up from L.A. with his car full of illegal booze, because we're in the middle of Prohibition, and his manager invited showgirls, which was, you know, pretty common in the 1920s, showgirls and chorus girls, and sort of B-movie actresses, extras, you know, who were all very pretty, came to these suites that they rented at the St. Francis, and they had a big party. There were Hollywood men there. There were these showgirls. And Fatty Arbuckle disappeared in a room with a woman named Virginia Rapay. She got sick with a lot of stomach pains, and within a few days, she was dead. So the Fatty Arbuckle case was very controversial because he was immediately arrested and initially charged with first-degree murder, but eventually charged with manslaughter. So the belief was not that he intentionally killed her. It was that they were having sexual relations. He had assaulted her, and he had in this process accidentally rolled over on her with all of his weight, crushing her and crushing her bladder, which caused toxic poisoning and eventually led to her death. Now, the flip side of this that Fatty's defense attorneys brought in was that Virginia already had a pre-existing inflammation of the bladder, and that coupled with a lot of alcohol would have caused her death also. So, you know, you've got, as is common now, you've got opposing experts. Nobody can really conclude what killed her. We just know she's dead, and this beautiful actress is gone, and you've got, you know, Fatty Arbuckle, the most famous person really in the country, behind bars in San Francisco. And so the prosecutor hires Oscar Heinrich, who comes in and investigates in the most meticulous way I've ever seen. He chronicles and catalogs and categorizes and documents everything you could think of that he found in the suite. The problem is that, as usual, Oscar is brought in a little late, often with cops are stumped. And so at this early stage in his career, you know, it's really like they're desperate and they bring him in, and sometimes he doesn't come in until pretty late into the case. And by that time, you know, the cops have already gone through it, people have walked through the evidence, and it's a compromised crime scene. This didn't stop him from going through and checking all of the handprints and fingerprints. And in the book you see photos. And in those photos, you see a couple of smeared handprints on the wall, of which Oscar Heinrich claimed that he could prove that Fatty Arbuckle had, you know, pressed the hands of Virginia Rapay against this door to stop her from leaving. And this doesn't prove assault or murder or anything else, but it was more circumstantial evidence that the prosecutor was depending on. And in this time period, there is a huge fight between the fundamental Christians in the United States, right, the very religious right, who is desperately trying to bring America back to the Victorian morals that it once had, and then Hollywood on the other side, which is becoming edgier and sexier, and women are not wearing corsets anymore. And then you've got Oscar Heinrich in the middle trying to figure out what happened. And the problem is a couple of things. One, he used fingerprints. And I know that, you know, a lot of your audience might think this is, you know, a reliable. We've always been taught that fingerprints were a reliable science. Mm-hmm. They absolutely are not. They are not. And if you think about it, you think about the process of leaving a fingerprint, right? So mm-hmm. you've got a suspect, or in this case, let's say Fatty Arbuckle, you've got this handprint on the door. And, you know, if you think about what he needs to compare it to, if you look at the cover of my book, that is Fatty Arbuckle's hand. It's actually a photo that Oscar took when he went to the jail and took his handprints and his thumbprints and fingerprints. So that is a very clear sample of his thumbprint and his handprints. That is not the case with the sample that was left on the door that he compared it to. It's smeared, it's inaccurate, and it's absolutely impossible to compare the whorls and, you know, the ridges that an expert is looking for. So this really came to light for me a couple of months ago when I had to go to the DMV, and I had to put my thumb down on that little scanny thing mm-hmm. four or five times. I couldn't get it right. So if that's the state of Texas telling me, you know, work harder to get your accurate thumbprint that, you know, it satisfies us. No, what is mostly left at a crime scene shouldn't be used in pattern matching, as is a lot of pattern matching. Shoe prints shouldn't be used.
Really?
Bite mark, but absolutely.
Surprises
bite
me, yeah.
So this is what's interesting. There are no federal regulations on the people who do these pattern matching comparisons. So a person at a sheriff's office in Texas, mm-hmm. who's supposedly an expert in fingerprints, is probably trained pretty differently than someone who is trained in Maine or in California. Mm-hmm. And one may be better than the other. Mm-hmm. So it's inaccurate. And bite mark evidence, there's a reason why bite mark evidence isn't admitted into court anymore. It's junk science. Or if it is admitted, it's not supposed to be.
Interesting. I always thought O.J. Simpson, those shoe prints were really key because he was wearing a very rare form of the Bruno Magli shoes.
Well,
they could,
you know,
actually trace back how many had been sold in the whole country and where he bought them. So it was,
well, and that could be the case, right, in certain circumstances.
Yeah, that's obviously unusual.
It shouldn't be relied on under any circumstances. It shouldn't be the only thing that convicts someone, and it has been. And there are people in prison who have been convicted on bad science. And Oscar Heinrich is responsible for some of it.
Yeah, do you think
same pattern analysis is another one, you know?
In this case, do you think do you think Fatty was really innocent or?
Oh yeah, absolutely.
Oh, you do? Okay.
There's absolutely no doubt. He got
interesting.
Such a bad rap out of
it. It destroyed his career, didn't it?
It absolutely did. So Oscar single-handedly hung a jury four times in this case, and the last jury, finally, the prosecutor wouldn't give it up. The last jury acquitted him in like less than 10 minutes. I can't even remember what I put in the book. It was very quick. And, you know, people just didn't believe it anymore. And on Oscar was so interesting because what you wouldn't know, unless you did like I did and read all of his letters, was that he absolutely despised Hollywood. He despised Fatty Arbuckle.
Oh.
And he thought he was guilty before he processed all of the information. That's problematic.
It is problematic.
You know, but you're human, you know, and you have biases and biases, and you just don't, you know, it's hard to stop them. But, boy, he could have tried harder.
And I must say from the cases, I don't know, there's 10 cases or whatever in the book. On the other ones, he's all dead on all the time, right? That's why I was saying I was convinced that he must have been really right on this one, even though I didn't get convicted. But
right, and he was wrong some of the time. And what else is telling that I think is telling about other investigators, cops, prosecutors, defense attorneys, is how kind of dug in they get into a case, and they won't let it go, and they won't admit they're wrong.
Yeah.
And so in these letters, about 2,000 that I read, with his closest confidants, he never admitted he was wrong. He never had any doubt. He sent six people to death row in San Quentin, six people in the same year.
Wow.
He never showed any doubt. And again, I think that's problematic. I do, you know? So I think that, especially at the beginning of forensics, you know, I mean, you think the first time that people conducted surgeries or used anesthesia that there weren't mistakes? Of course there are mistakes. It's the first time you're using a new technique, and he made mistakes. Even when cases were reversed against him, he just said they're crazy. I mean, and these guys are going to reoffend. So, you know, it's interesting. I think you have to have that bravado to a certain extent, but I think it really was difficult for him to admit when he was wrong. He had such an ego, and of course we know Sherlock Holmes was the same way, so it all tallies, you know, it all is in line with his nickname.
Let me ask you a question. It's a little bit of a digression, but we talked about his financial problems. He's doing 40 cases a month. You said 2,000 in his career. How is he paid for these things? Was a lot of this like pro bono work? Or
no, none of it. He refused to do pro bono work.
So why wasn't he making a ton of money with 40 cases a month?
Well, he was making a lot of money. The problem was he was spending it faster than he had it.
Oh, okay.
So, a couple reasons. He opened up, I think, prematurely, a San Francisco office. Forensics is incredibly expensive. I mean, if you think about just what it takes to do to have a photo lab with all of that material, it's incredible. He was responsible for his own travel, so he had to depend on people paying him on time, no one arguing with his fee, which was high, you know, but it was in line with what their forensic scientists were charging, including with the federal government. Now, I think the biggest, what he points to, as you read in the book, is the constant conflict that he had with his sons, kind of from an early age.
Yeah.
They cost him money. They were wrecking cars. He was sending them around the world to have life experiences he never had, to private universities.
Mm-hmm.
His son went to Cambridge. Yeah. I mean, you know, this is a lot of money. And up until the day he died, he was sending his eldest son money. Until the day he died, this guy was in his 40s, you know, and working at a museum in New York, and Oscar was still supporting him.
Wow.
So that answers answers your question.
Let me ask you about this case, just because I'm interested in Ponzi schemes and con men. And this chemist story where it was the perfect murder.
It was. It was. Yeah. So, you know, I think we call it the calculating chemist. So you'll notice that I start. Okay. So most people are not going to know this. I don't think anybody's picked up on this. But if you read the top of every chapter, there's a Sherlock Holmes quote.
Yes.
If you pay attention, each quote is about a different Sherlock Holmesian piece of forensics that he uses. And it's what Heinrich uses in the case. Nobody's called me on that before. So, you know, you'll notice, like, in a case where he uses forensic geology, the Holmes quote is connected to forensic geology. I spent a lot of time, I want a credit for that, because I spent a lot of time looking through Sherlock Holmes stories.
Well, it went right over my head, because I tried to read them, and they were, I don't know, so it went over my head.
The Conan speak, which is kind of difficult sometimes. So the calculating chemist, you know, comes down to a lot of different things, and it is deduction. So this happened in 1925, right in the middle of my crazy time period, the Roaring Twenties, where banks were just handing out money to any yahoo who claimed to have a good idea. And one of those yahoos was a guy named Charles Schwartz, who was a chemist, a legitimate chemist, in California. And he was in Northern California, and he claimed that he had essentially what turned out to be nylon, synthetic silk. Silk was the most expensive material, at the time, a textile, and it was used in tires. I mean, gosh, it was used in everything. But I kind of have a graphic description of what it takes to make silk, and it's murdering a bunch of silkworms, and it takes forever. So this was a big deal, and he said, I have it. I've got the formula to make synthetic silk. He had a lot of investors, and he turns up dead one night in a huge explosion in his factory. And he's got a big insurance policy. He's got a charred body and a grieving widow. And Oscar is brought in because the cops are just thinking something's really weird, but they didn't know. And so Oscar's brought in, and he, what I call, brings in this razzle-dazzle forensics. First of all, he looks around the factory and goes, this guy is not a chemist.
Yeah.
He doesn't even have running water.
Yeah.
You know, he's got these vats of really dangerous, liquids. So Oscar was a trained chemist. He was a chemical engineer, and he had a degree in chemistry from UC Berkeley. So he was rare. He was one of those rare forensic scientists who actually was professionally trained in a lot of different disciplines. So he recognized that this was not a real chemist. So immediately he starts thinking this is some kind of scheme, and he looks at where the fire was set, and he realizes the fire was set on the body, essentially underneath the body. And then his wife says, Schwartz's wife says, listen, you know, my husband had his tooth removed. A couple of weeks ago, look at the tooth. And Oscar determines the tooth was chipped out. Hmm. It wasn't actually removed before death. It was removed after death.
Cool.
So it's a lot of other clues, you know, that just shows, like, you know, the amount of blood and, you know, how, and so it, you know, I'm not going to ruin the ending. I've already ruined a lot of it. But, you know, the person who is actually laying in the morgue is a surprise. And, you know, he is able to identify the person. He's able to, you know, call Schwartz a fraud, and Schwartz goes on the run and has a pretty bad ending himself. So it was a great story and a big breakthrough for Oscar that really, it just made headlines for years and years and years.
Maybe Madoff should abuse that as a get out of town that way.
It certainly would have been simpler than what he did, I think.
We have 2 minutes left in this segment. Why don't you do the handwriting one, the priest, the baker? That was also pretty cool.
Yeah, so it's, Oscar really believed in handwriting analysis. Not to burst your bubble, Jim, but it is also considered pattern matching and
junk science.
Disappoint people, but you just can't. Your handwriting can change based on medication you're taking. Certainly, your environment, how much sleep you've had. It's just inaccurate. So, but Heinrich believed in it. He didn't actually use handwriting analysis. He did sort of in the case of a missing priest. And there was a ransom note. He sort of used it. What he did was actually do criminal profiling, which was almost never used, very rarely used in the United States, to profile someone before they were caught. They were profiled after to establish sanity on, you know, for trial, but not before. And so Heinrich looked at this guy's handwriting in the ransom note and said, I know exactly what this guy did for a living. I don't know who he is, but he was a professional baker.
It's pretty mind-boggling.
That's exactly what happened, and that's what happened. The suspect was a professional baker. He just did it based on the way this guy did his lettering. It was incredible.
He also identified grains of sand, right? The differentials and...
Yep, it's called forensic geology. It's still used today. He had the first case and second case ever used in the United States. It was remarkable. So we can talk about that case when we come back if you want.
All right, we've come back for our final segment with Kate Wakeford-Austin. Stay with us. Our final segment, Kate Winkler-Dawson. She's a documentarian, professor at the University of Texas, Austin, and has written a state-of-the-art book on the beginning of forensics. And there's a bunch of other cases in this book that you're going to want to read that that we haven't touched on. We are going to touch on one more that involves an ear, right?
Yeah, and that's actually my favorite case. And then I want to give you kind of an exclusive of a case that wasn't in the book,
but okay.
Which involved very little forensics, but I just love the way he was thinking. So the case that you're talking about is the case of Bessie Ferguson, and there's a picture of her in the center of the book. And it's a very actually sad case, and it affected Oscar more than I would have suspected it did. Essentially, it starts out pretty gruesome. This poor boy is in El Cerrito and looking for some plants for a centerpiece for his mom in a swamp outside his house, and he finds what he thinks is a dead bird, and it's actually an ear attached to scalp. In no other body, and they're dredging, you know, this area. They can't find anything. The bugs have already gotten to it, and at this point, and this is in 1925, Oscar had been really well established, and so the cops didn't even bother trying. They just sent it to him directly and said, basically, their conclusion was, we don't even know if this is a male or female, but probably dead, which is an understatement. You cannot get away with it. No scalp and no ear,
yeah,
most likely. So, you know, I have really great photos of him with a body parts, and unfortunately I have pretty graphic photos of the scalp and the ear that are not included in a book. So he immediately examines the ear, and he says, you know, this is a pierced ear, so this would be not just a woman, but a trendy woman, because this was not, you know, this was just the beginning of the trend of women piercing their ears and not using clip-ons. You know, clip-ons were sort of a remnant of the Victorian era. So she was trendy, and he was, you know, made a lot of pretty incredible deductions. But what the cop said is, please help us find the rest of her. We don't know who this is. Help identify her and find the rest of her, and then, of course, find the killer. So that was a tall order, and he was busy with the Schwartz case. He's trying to find this calculating chemist and, you know, put this guy away. So he was a busy man along with the other 20 or 30 cases he was dealing with. He examines the ear, and he did it in a meticulous way, you know, that I talked about. He rolls up his sleeves, and he's got, I have a great photo of him wearing a smock and his little glasses, and he starts examining the ear, and there are a couple of things he notices. One is blowfly larvae, which is pretty gross. It's at the back of the ear. Now, why this is telling is that it's a part of forensic entomology, which is the way that bugs arrive to a corpse. And anybody who watches CSI is probably familiar with this. It's a real discipline. We still use it, and he was the first to use it in the United States. He looks at the blowfly larvae, and he knows from his books that bugs arrive in a certain order to a corpse.
Wow.
And it's just universal, and it still happens. Blowflies come first. They lay their eggs. I think beetles are next. There's a pretty specific succession of them. But there was nothing else. It was just blowfly. So he knew that he could tell the cops that the body was, the woman was killed between 24 and 48 hours. So he's established time of death. Right. He searches the ear, and he finds tiny, tiny, tiny grains of sand, which is a little stunning because there's no sand in this marsh where she was found in this swampy area. It's all thick black mud. So he looks at this grain of sand.
Wow.
And he runs a test. And it's a test that he ran when he was a sanitary engineer when he was much younger in Tacoma, Washington, where he was from. So out of college, he was hired as a sanitary engineer to help, like, you know, with sanitation in the city. And he was in charge of helping build infrastructure and roads. And he ran a special test using a very special microscope that was essentially a prism that could light up different sections of a piece of sand that would tell him the different parts. It's like got salt in it, it's this amount of salt, it's got this amount of seashells, it's got this amount of whatever. So he lights it up, and he then goes to a geological map after he's found out the compound, and he looks at the map, and he finds out the closest area, and he circles it, and that's 12 miles away. And the cops say, how do you know this? And he says, the salt deposit is very, very small, but it's still there. So this is not sand that's on an ocean beach. It's sand that's connected to a creek or a river that dumps into the ocean.
Wow.
And then he says, based on how smooth the sand is, it's a very slow-moving creek or river. And so he narrows it down to this one particular area 12 miles away, and they say, you're nuts. And he says, go look, and they find the body. And it's dismembered, cut up in parts, strewn all across this area. So I won't talk about the killer. I won't talk about any of that because I ruin everything, Jim, and I vowed never to do it again.
No, I want to mention one other thing. Hopefully it won't. But I was also amazed in the way the cutting was done. He deduced what level of,
right.
I won't go farther, of career that he must be in and not farther within that career.
Yeah. And it's and you know, it's funny. If you kind of looked up this case, then you would see that you know, there are some articles that say, oh, you know, this is the main suspect, this guy Gordon Rowe. And that was not his suspect. He had exonerated that guy. He really suspected someone else that's never been mentioned, but he names. and it falls into that career that you're talking about. It's a fascinating case, and the woman, Bessie Ferguson, who was the victim, I'll just tell you because, oh boy, you know, this woman, she was extorting money from men who she was claiming they were all the father of children she never even had.
Yeah.
So there, we're talking about a lot of suspects.
Yeah, there was stuff going on there with her.
As
we finish up, one thing you kind of touched on before, but there is really no federal or standard for crime labs, right?
No.
Which is why we have a lot of good defense lawyers know how to play that.
Well, they do. And, you know, you call a Daubert hearing, which, you know, if you're a defense attorney or a prosecutor and the opposing side has an expert or a, you know, discipline that they say, oh, my gosh, you're crazy. We shouldn't let this in. Here's the problem. Judges don't know science. Most of them don't. So you're looking at a judge who really doesn't understand, and he'll look at precedents and say, well, they let this in the state of Tennessee. We're in Texas. Let's do that, too. So it can be very, you know, troubling.
How do you end up on Oscar, his most impressive accomplishment or his legacy, or how does it hit you after having spent all this time with him?
Well, you know, he's got some pretty impressive, you know, reading the book, he's got some pretty impressive developments. He was the first to use forensic geology, the first to use, you know, forensic entomology, the bugs that I mentioned. There are a lot of them. I think I'm a professor at the University of Texas in Austin, so I humbly say that my legacy is the impact I have on my students, and I think that's the same. He took all of these skills and applied them to every single student, the thousands that he influenced over decades, who then went on to join their own, you know, detective agencies or police departments. So that was his legacy. It was incredibly important, and we still see it today.
That's a good point. All right. Thanks to Kate Winkler-Dawson, American Sherlock, Murder Forensics, The Birth of American CSI. There are a lot of other cases in there that we didn't touch on. Plus, you can find out the endings of some of the ones she didn't spoil. It's been Forensic Talk with Jim Campbell. Go to YouTube right now. We've just got Jim Campbell Radio up that consolidates both Business Talk and Forensic Talk, all our podcasts. You can subscribe to it, stay up to date each week's guest. See everybody on the next edition of Forensic Talk with Jim Campbell.